Today we have a very special guest joining us once again, the renowned journalist, historian, and best-selling author of Empireland, Satnam Sengera. In this episode, we're diving into his latest publication, Stolen History, The Truth About the British Empire and How It Shaped Us. Readers have been raving about this book, describing it as a clear, non-patronizing, and highly effective guide to understanding the impact and legacy of the British Empire. What sets this book apart is its accessibility to younger readers, making it an essential introduction to the British Empire for those 9 and above. Together with Satnam, we'll be exploring 10 intriguing questions, delving into topics like how did Satnam make the complex subject of the British Empire appropriate and engaging for a younger audience, what motivated Satnam to write a book about the British Empire for younger readers, and why parents listening should buy this book for their kids. Also prepared to uncover a treasure trove of intriguing and lesser known facts, such as the remarkable story of how the insignificant location of New Amsterdam was swapped for the highly significant island of Run, the shocking truth about the Royal African Company founded by the Duke of York, who would later become King of England, and their branding of enslaved Africans with DY. And did you know that gin and tonic actually doesn't have colonial roots? We'll explore that and many more interesting tidbits about tea, sugar, and beyond. So join us as we embark on another captivating journey down the rabbit hole of history with another guest. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe to our channel to stay up to date with all the latest videos. With that out of the way, let's get started. The first question that I have to start with, considering your new book, is how did you take a complex topic such as the history of the British Empire and not only make it accessible, but also age appropriate for young readers? Because I think if I remember correctly, the book's aimed at children 9 and over.
Yes, aimed at kids 9 to 11. I basically try to tell the story of empire through everyday items is one of the strategies. I mean, there's so much about a modern child's life that can be explained by empire, like sugar, one of the great narratives of British Empire. And also the great narratives of a kid's life, right? Sugar. Tea, if you're Indian or English, they have a great narrative, but also a narrative of a child and a narrative of empire. But things like the Scouts, a lot of kids are still members of the Scout, which were set up to create an imperial generation. They were going to be called the Imperial Scouts at one point. Nutmeg, you know, probably not a spice that kids know by name, but they will have tasted it if they've had a gingerbread man, I guess, or if they're having pumpkin lattes. They're probably too young to have pumpkin lattes, but they will have come across it. But these are everyday things that will touch a child's life. But then you can also tell the story through human beings, which is a way that empires always been taught. Like, but going back to the 19th century, they would focus on the heroes of empire, people like Charles Gordon. But now we can focus on more complex characters like Charles Sancho and Gandhi and so on. But ultimately, what I realized was that you have to, with kids this age, explain the history in ways that feel relevant to them. So use analogies that are relevant, not least school. But as I explain in the book, empire is the exact opposite to the way school works, in that then there wasn't a headmaster and the classrooms were often very disparate, and sometimes the teachers were nice, sometimes they were complete bastards. Sometimes they made the work, the kids do the work, you know, and sometimes it would take 4 months to get a message from one classroom to the other. So by using these kind of analogies, hopefully I managed to explain the basics of British Empire.
Why then even bother to write a book for children in the first place? Like, I think a lot of people may think firsthand, like, why even consider kind of taking the British Empire's history, especially in the current climate, and then kind of, I guess, repackage it for children?
Well, hopefully it's not repackaged, because essentially it's the same history, same facts. But there's one profound reason why, and that's because I was in my 40s until I realized that we have a multicultural society in Britain today because we had a multicultural empire. Seems really obvious now, but, you know, I grew up with a narrative that brown people came here uninvited and we were taking advantage of the white British, right? And that was the narrative in Enoch Powell's Wolverhampton. And I think it's still the dominant, weirdly, narrative in the media about immigration. And if I'd known at the age of 9 that actually we were here for deep historical reason, you know, that millions of brown and black people fought in both world wars, that would have changed my life. It would have changed my sense of place in this country. So I think that's really important.
considering then the current climate, and I think at the moment there's a National Conservative Conference or whatever going on, and all sorts of crazy takes of are coming out of that place. One of the things that often, and I'm sure it will get discussed at this conference too, is imperial nostalgia. Like, how did you handle the concept of trying to be honest with... Because I think sometimes when you try to explain things to kids, we have a tendency to make it kind of a little bit more rosy and kind of nice rather than the harsh realities of what life can be like. Like, how did you kind of deal with kind of portraying it as best as possible, but also being sensitive to the fact they're children?
Yeah, I mean, that was something I was really sensitive to, because I actually said no to a kid's book a few months before I said yes to this one. And I didn't want to sanitize the history. I just thought, if you're writing about empire, you're going to have to gloss over the violence of slavery and the general violence. And so when I spoke to Puffin, I did, that was my first question. I mean, I was, can I talk about the facts of slavery? Can I mention the fact that, you know, for example, you know, when some slaves arrived on Barbados, they were branded with the initials of the Duke of York, because they were freed by the Royal African Company. And they said it was absolutely possible to say it, but you can't be gratuitous about it. And actually, obviously, the first thing I did when I got commissioned was to see if there were similar books. The only book I found was A Horrible History's Guide to British Empire. And I love those guys. I think they've got so many kids into history. But that book is really misjudged, because it's got jokes about the violence of slavery. And it's of its time. You know, it wouldn't come out today. But even at that time, he got done for being woke. You know, they got absolutely crucified by right-wing parents. Or if you look at the reviews online for that book, lots of people thought it was too liberal. And now reading it, you can't believe how brutal some of the details are. And like, I don't think there's any jokes to be made about slavery. It's been like the Holocaust. Maybe they are, I mean, that's a whole philosophical question. But anyway, I wanted to be able to talk about some of the violence, and I managed to do that.
Yeah, no, definitely. I did enjoy reading through the book, although it was a lot easier to read through than perhaps some of the other books that I have to read for this. But it was definitely worthwhile.
Did you learn anything, though? Because you're an expert, man.
Oh, I wish I was an expert. I think for me, what was really enjoyable was the fact that, especially after having read Empireland as well, is it's even for adults, it's almost like a bullet point list of facts. So it's kind of like, here is a piece of history about empire, but here is then all of the facts in almost like a chronological order. And then you can kind of take that from all the analogies you're using, especially the ones like you're in a classroom or whatever. So I think the relatability of it, even for an adult, like, there's still something you can take from it. Obviously, it's not targeted to adults, but like, nonetheless, I don't think it would be out of place on anyone's bookshelf, although it is for children. Like, as in, I think there is a lot that you can still take from it, irrespective of your age.
I learned a lot, actually, and I thought, you know, I knew a lot about empire, but like, I didn't know about HV Source. I didn't know it stood for Houses of Parliament, and that it used ingredients from empire. I didn't know about London Zoo. I didn't know it had been set up by Raffles, the guy who set up Singapore. Did you know that?
I didn't know that, no.
Yeah, there were loads of things you keep on discovering, because it's just a massive subject, isn't it?
How then do you kind of deal with, like, critics who would argue that discussing these aspects of the British Empire, people that would say that they're negative, in a children's book, amounts to kind of attacking British pride or British patriotism or xenophobia or whatever you want to call it? Like, what would your response be to that, I guess?
I mean, the idea that you study history in order to feel pride or shame is just bizarre. It's like saying, I study maths because I'm proud of maths. I'm proud of the weather. It's just too complicated for that, man. It's so inane. I think even the idea of, if someone had come into a history lesson and said that to me at the age of 9, I would have thought it was a strange thing to say, because we were being told things, and none of it was about pride or shame. It was just the facts of what happened in Britain, right?
Yeah.
And so this is more, I think this is a cultural thing, and the only way to take it on is to speak the truth. To be honest, I was very nervous, about, you know, talking about the racism of empire. Because let's face it, there's now some fringe people who've got big platforms who go about arguing that British Empire wasn't racist. It's complete fake history. Every single imperial historian I've ever read, including Niall Ferguson and Jan Morris, who loved the empire, they all acknowledged that empire was proudly white supremacy. Right. But now you've got this, it's just part of the general, you know, move away from experts. We don't need to listen to imperial historians. We don't need to listen to the scientists when it comes to COVID. We don't need to listen to the results of the vote in America. We just decide what we think ourselves. And the only way to respond to that is truth. So I have to talk about it. I have to talk about the racism of British Empire because it's a fact. It's what all the experts say. And if some people, if that upsets some people, so what? I mean, we're talking about peer-reviewed history here, you know?
Yeah.
It's not something I'm just making up.
No, of course not. Yeah, no, as in you've got me thinking with some of these answers. Sorry, sidetracked. Anyway, coming back to some of the questions. One then is, what were perhaps some of, like you mentioned earlier, that there were some facts that you were learning even whilst you were putting this together. What are perhaps some of the more shocking or surprising things that you came across just like, I guess, as you were kind of refreshing yourself for this?
You know, shocking facts. I mean,
or perhaps surprising. So I think like the HP Source one, for a lot of people, that's quite surprising. And I didn't know about the London Zoo thing either. That for me is a new one.
One of my favorite facts is in the book is about Lutie, you know, the dog. Basically, when the British and French pillaged the Imperial Summer Palace in Peking, they stole a dog, the Pekingese dog, and they called it Lutie. I mean, that's how unashamed they were about looting. They called it Lutie. Then they gave it to Queen Victoria. I think it was the first Pekingese dog in Britain.
Right. Which,
and it apparently sparked a whole fashion for Pekingese dogs. And then she had it painted. So if you look up Lutie in the Royal Collection, you'll find a portrait of the dog. It's incredible. But that's how unashamed the British were about looting, you know. And I guess my other fact I love is that, you know, when the British were fighting the Dutch to take control of the island of Run, to control Nutmeg because it was so valuable, it ended up with them settling and the Dutch swapping the colony of Run for New Amsterdam. So yeah, we ended up with New Amsterdam, New York City, and they ended up with a tiny island called Run, which was really valuable then, but it's probably not so much now.
No. What was the other thing that I think it's mentioned in your book as well about like tonic water and how that's related to British Empire history?
So what's the tonic water?
Well,
yeah.
Tonic water.
You know what? That's actually my book I'm writing now. Do you know that idea? I don't go into alcohol because I was told it wasn't suitable for kids.
Which
I
is wanted to. Yeah.
But it turns out, I found out recently, you know the idea that gin and tonic is an imperial creation?
Yeah.
It's not. It wasn't. There's actually no evidence. Alcohol was taken with quinine as a way of fighting off malaria, but never gin. Tonic water developed associations of a health drink, and people were taking quinine with alcohol, and this one guy just merged the two and created this drink, but it wasn't specifically taken as in a medicinal way in the British Empire.
So actually what was happening is people were just drinking alcohol with
quinine to take their quinine, yeah,
rather than having
other
the
kind
gin
of alcohol
tonic.
Not gin.
Yeah.
And they were taking quinine through tonic water as well.
Schweppes created the first tonic, like carbonated tonic water, because of wanting to pair it with other, like there was just like a fashion for tonics at this point, like creating,
yeah, exactly,
all these
it was
new
like
things.
It's like a health drink. It was like considered to be refreshing. But gin and tonic, apparently, I was told by an expert, was never taken because the amount of quinine in a gin and tonic is not enough to give you your dose of quinine.
So it's one
no,
of those
it's nowhere
things.
Near.
It's one of those myths just to make you drink more gin and tonics, I guess.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, but it just happens to be a refreshing drink, which people were probably drinking in India, you know, because it tasted good.
That's interesting. It's interesting because I've been doing some research into tonic water and like, so hence why the Schweppes thing, but you piqued my interest with that.
It's in my next book and it explains it probably more clearly than I have done just now.
I look forward to that one as well. From all of the research that you've had to do for this book and obviously for the previous Empire Land, if you could meet one figure from British Empire history, who would it be and why?
It would probably have to be Dee Mohammed, who I'm obsessed with. It was the first Indian writer to write in English, the guy who set up the first curry house in Britain, became a kind of massage therapist to the king in Brighton. Amazing man, you know, came from Patna in India. But also, I guess, also Charles Sancho, you know, he was the first black person to vote in Britain. He was the first black person in Britain to publish his own music. And he was the first known black person to have his obituary printed in a newspaper when he did. Also, he fought for abolition, right? And nowadays, the narrative of abolition is that Wilberforce and a bunch of white people did it single-handedly, but actually some black people played prominent roles in it, and there are some tributes to him around London, a couple of small ones. I think we need a statue. I mean, there's so many statues and tributes to William Wilberforce. What about the black people who, you know, paid such a huge price? But yeah, he was formerly enslaved as well. It's an incredible thing. He achieved all of this despite being enslaved.
That's nuts. You could write whole books on just these individuals, so yeah.
And people are. I think someone's just written a novel about him, actually.
I know, so with the copy that I got, some of the illustrations were not yet complete, but with the illustrations that will be in the book once it's published, what are you aiming to represent pictorially? Like, what is kind of the... Like, so the only reason I ask is because I remember reading... I don't know if he is just my generation who grew up in the 90s, but like, there were... The series of Roald Dahl books that were illustrated by, I forgot the guy's name now, I'm sure everyone...
Quentin Blake.
Yeah, that's it. And those illustrations stick out, like, in my mind still to this day. So, in a similar fashion, kind of what are you aiming to achieve in this book with the illustrations? Obviously, it's a kid's book, hence, I guess, the need for kind of extra kind of material that engages them at such a young age. But what is, like, I guess, the objective?
The illustrator is Jen Cartoon, and actually her style is very much like Quentin Blake's. That's what I noticed as well. In a very simple way, you know, British Empire is such a complex idea. You know, it's a hard concept to even get your head around. At one point it was a company, then it became a state endeavor. There were so many different forms of it. People disagree about when it began, when it ended. Anything you can do to humanize it, to point out what the people were actually doing, is a good thing, not just for kids, but for adults too. And I think photos and illustrations are especially important when you're speaking to kids, because I think it's quite easy to lose people when you're talking about British Empire. It can feel like a long way away. And the more you can relate your life to their life and bring empire and make it a real thing, the better.
For any parents that are listening, I guess their question would be, why would or should they even buy your book for their kids? What is your objective with this book? Like, what are you aiming to achieve? And why, I guess, should parents be getting it for their children?
I guess it goes back to the whole explanation for why we're a multicultural society. And also, I think we need to understand why we still have racism. I know there's an idea in Britain that we are now post-racial because we've got Rishi Sunak. You know,
that's a whole debate in its own right. I had my... I had my mom's brother come from America a few weeks back for my grandfather's like 95th birthday or something, and he's like, don't you think essentially racism has ended, or kind of there's equality now that Rishi Sunak's white? And me and my older brother kind of were explaining to him that, like, to a degree, yeah, on the surface, his skin color, like, just that fact on its own, the skin color does speak to some degree. But then there's the question of, what does he actually represent? And does he represent kind of those principles that perhaps the South Asian community would kind of say they represent? A lot of the community don't think he represents us whatsoever. And actually, it doesn't necessarily mean that now racism has ended. Like, as in this, it's far more subtle than it just being like, oh, while he's if an Indian can be prime minister, therefore there must be no racism.
It's like Barack Obama. I mean, he was president. That I can't help noticing that racism didn't end when he became president. And, you know, but it ties into the narrative that we have in Britain that we are beyond racism. You know, we abolished slavery. We beat the evil racist Germans in World War II. Therefore, we are completely incapable of racism. And that helps us forget that empire was really proudly white supremacist. And actually, we spread a whole load of white supremacist ideas around the world, to America, to the colonies, to settler colonies like Australia, which had a white Australia policy. You know, you don't get much more obviously racist than that. South Africa, oh my God. I mean, these were clearly, proudly racist endeavors, and they were imperial in many respects. And I think you can be really delighted with the fact that we've got a British Asian Prime Minister. And I think I didn't expect to see it in my lifetime. At the same time as saying, you know what, we've got deep problems with racism, and a lot of them can be explained by the fact that we had a really pretty racist empire.
Penultimate question then, what do you hope that young readers will do after reading your book?
Well, I hope they read some actual history. I don't mean to say that my books aren't actual history, but I think there are, I mean, empire is a really difficult thing to get your head around, but there are accessible books out there. Like, you can break down empire. You can read books on the food in empire. You know, you could read a book about the history of tea, you know. And I think as a teenager, you can pick up these books. And if you read enough of them, you end up getting a quite a deep sense of empire. Or you could pick up one of William Dalrymple's books, you know, and focus on one particular period of India. Or read a book about the Sikh Empire. The Sikh Empire is a very useful way into this history because it was very short, wasn't it?
Yeah.
No, and also really dramatic.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's boring history. It was incredible. It was like the entire Games of Thrones multi-series all within like 70 years, wasn't it?
On steroids. And then add deep like Bollywood drama into it as well, I imagine. Yeah,
yeah, the ending of the Sikh Empire is just unbelievable. But yeah, so you can focus on smaller things and slowly get a sense of the bigger subject.
Last question then, what can we expect from you in the future? You obviously mentioned that you're working on another book. I don't know how much you can mention or not, but in kind of vague terms, what can we expect from you in the next,
I guess, the rest of the year? I'm going to say anyway, who cares? I'm writing a sequel to Empire Land, but Empire World, How Britain Shaped the Planet. So I've been traveling to all sorts of places, looking at how British empires has shaped places like India, Nigeria, and Barbados. Yeah, it's been really fascinating.
Mad.
Coming out next January.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to it. I will obviously be reading it and I will definitely be in touch. Yeah. No, that's been about half an hour or so. I've got through all of the questions that I thought were relevant and like decent to get through.
Great. Thanks.
Do you think there's anything that you want to mention or anything that you think we missed out?
No, I mean, I guess one thing I've been researching recently is that actually how empire was taught in the past in Britain.
Ooh, okay.
And we have an idea that, you know, empire's never been taught and actually we're only beginning to teach it now. But actually there's been phases where we have taught it. But at the height of empire, the 19th century, it wasn't being taught very well. And there was massive anxiety, as there is now, about how can we teach this better? But their motivations were different. Now we want to teach about multiculturalism and racism. They wanted to keep the empire together. And they were like, people like the Royal Colonial Institute were worrying that, you know, if kids don't understand empire, how are they going to keep it together? How are they going to continue this master race, you know? And so they were lobbying schools. And weirdly, it wasn't history through which people were taught about empire eventually. It was geography. History wasn't a standard subject in many British schools until quite late. Geography was much more of a set subject. So that was where the prism through which people learned about empire. But then it seems to have been taught quite a lot, but in a very jingoistic way. For, you know, the early 20th century, then it kind of faded, then it came back for a bit in the 1970s, then it faded again. But it's something we go around in circles with. We've never really worked out how to properly teach it.
Interesting. I do remember learning about British Empire at university. I think there were two modules that we were allowed
to pick.
What
was your subject?
I did a history degree, obviously. In my second year, there were two. I think in the set of options you got to pick from, both sets had one option that was British Empire each. So I ended up picking both. And I remember all of the recommended reading at that point was like Niall Ferguson and people kind of that.
And even that was unusual. I mean, so many people get in touch with me who say they did history at Oxford or Cambridge and they learned nothing about the British Empire.
I guess that's one thing I'd appreciated with Royal Holloway was it, like, as in just the breadth and scope that we were just submerged in. So I think there was like a first year module that basically dealt with, it was called like 20th century figures and something, and it was basically looking at people like, I don't know, Fanon, Gandhi, Nkrumah, all of these like resistance fighters in the 20th century. So like I guess I was fortunate, but it's interesting to know that that's the anomaly, because for me I just thought that was normal.
Yeah, and got some of the, I found some of the material that was used to teach about empire in the 20th century so racist, unbelievable. I've actually posted some of it on Instagram, but just things like black people are lazy, they won't work unless they're compelled to, and these are textbooks that were used up to the 1960s. You know, it's really shocking.
But I guess, I know we're coming to the end of the time, but I guess what's interesting is that, like, to some degree, that rhetoric had, like, so, again, going back to my own family, like, my grandfather was born in India, lived in the UK for a while, and then ended up staying in America for, like, the majority of his life and worked and whatever. And he always has this conversation with me about kind of racism, because in America, he doesn't really, he's brown, he doesn't really suffer racism. Per se, obviously, it's a different makeup there. And I'm always like, yo, like, things haven't really changed. Like, as in, it may be more subtle, they may say it quieter, it might not be to your face, but, like, as in, it still happens. But coming back to today, like, sure, like, I would argue it's never gone away. It's always been there. It's always been kind of in the background. I just think people were perhaps better at hiding it. I don't know, like, I don't know quite, like, how to explain it, but I don't think it's ever not been an issue. And I think it's, again, kind of feeds into that British nostalgia of, like, we're the good guys, like, we fought the Nazis and, like, we did this and we, like, got rid of slavery. And I think it feeds into that rather than actually being just, like, truthful, or just, like, actually kind of just being reflective and honest about it.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard work facing up to the facts. Much easier to just be nostalgic, think everything was nice.
But I guess equally, if we have people like Boris Johnson, like, getting away with calling hijab women letterboxes, and you have things like this repeatedly occurring and there being no issue, then, like, it's almost like the precedent's set, like, as in there's nothing. And there doesn't seem to be any repercussions for anything either. Like, as in, it just seems like people get away with blue murder.
Yeah, the weird thing is racism is now just so much more obvious and daily and evident on every page of every newspaper. And yet the denial of it is even more profound. It's a massive paradox.
That in itself would leave us here for hours and hours. So before we spiral into that, I will just cut it out. But obviously, thank you for this. I appreciate just even having this chance. The book was really good fun to read through, and it was nice to be able to get a copy before it was out. That is quite unique.
I appreciate your support, man.
No, not a problem. Thank you so much.
I enjoy what you do.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm going to listen to your podcast on, which you sent me about the, what is it, the ceremony
about Vaisakhi.
Vaisakhi, yeah.
You'll enjoy it. For someone who's interested in history and also for someone who's having to do research, I think you'll enjoy it. Hopefully you'll enjoy the podcast.
Well, I've downloaded it. I'm just going to find time to read it. I'll do that soon.
Yeah, thanks, I know, man. That's always the issue, right? No, no problem. Take care, mate.
Take care. Bye.
And that's a wrap for today's podcast episode, folks. I hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. A massive shout out to our awesome YouTube members, especially the new ones, Vishal Kuldar, Sanji, and Jagraj. A special heartfelt thanks to our older members, Raj Saran, Kulbir Singh, Ricardo Kular, Wushu Man, Not Devan, Pujangi, Humejit Singh, Amanveer Mandir, Hunter Hid, Radhajit Kohl, Gurmeet Dunjal, Gary Parmar, N Singh, GS, and Jazz Dylan. Let's not forget also our amazing Patreon members, including Neil B, Hernan Pazano, Jazz Dylan, Gurpreet Singh, Gurdeep Bhatt, Himmat Singh Khalsa, Anish Mann, Ramneek Kaur, Mani Singh, Rav Singh, Yasmin Jaswal, Ramneek Kaur, Gagan Singh, and Gurpreet Dunjal. If you're passionate about the work I'm doing and want to support it, consider becoming a paid YouTube member to unlock some cool features or join our Patreon community. You can find the links in the description below. Thanks again for tuning in, and I can't wait to bring you more exciting content. See you in the next one.